For the week of April 15th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 145, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. So you're back in Los Angeles, is what you should say.
Yes, I'm back in Los Angeles from Indio, California, the as I call it, the freezing sweaty desert, because it was raining on Friday. And you may be wondering, why are they starting the show talking about Indio, California and the desert? And that's because on today's show, we're going to be talking about Coachella, the annual music and arts festival, which takes place in Indio, California. And it's usually held the second or third weekend of April. And it's usually about 95 to 105 degrees. And they get 150,000 people onto a huge polo field to sweat and dance to about 150 acts. And this year, it decided to rain on the first of the three-day festival, and it was about 50 degrees.
Ouch. Everybody stayed in the tents from what I saw.
It was, well, you know, I think that was kind of overestimated. I think, you know, for the Black Keys, there were probably 65,000 people on that field in the rain. So I think, you know, sure, maybe during the day there were a few acts that people wanted to see in the tents, and then one at night, M83 was in the tents, but the tents were always full, so it didn't matter whether it was sunny or raining or hot or cold. The place is just packed.
So we'll be talking about Coachella. What else are we covering this week?
Well, we'll be joined by Doug Freeman, a music critic for the Austin Chronicle and co-editor of the Austin Chronicle Music Anthology. He's going to be here to talk about the supposed death of music blogging, and he'll explain a little bit more about that when he's on. The government is getting involved in ebooks, Michael, which I thought would interest you. That's one way of looking at it, you know, at their antitrust lawsuit, which we've spoken about before, against publishers over collusion. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines, or as many as we can cram in. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the Hunger Games news. I'm sorry, the weekend's box office.
That's not the news at the box office this weekend. The number one movie around the world is Titanic. In 3D, it grossed $110 million worldwide this weekend, and including an extraordinary $67 million in China.
Well, wait, Michael, I'm going to have to interrupt you because I think somehow you must have gotten some notes mixed up with one of our shows from 1997.
No. This is the reissue of Titanic. It grossed $110 million worldwide this weekend. It's at $202 million worldwide total. The film as a whole, when you include all the money it's made, it crosses the $2 billion mark. So it's just a remarkable weekend. It seems like a weird thing, this 3D reissuing of movies, but in fact, Hollywood has a long history of this. They used to re-release Sound of Music all the time. Gone with the Wind went in and out of theaters for decades until really a little bit the VHS and then finally the DVD. Movies got reissued in theaters a lot. Disney made a whole career out of reissuing their animated films every 7 years. So bringing back Titanic and bringing back these other movies, 3D is an excuse, but it is sort of a return to the tradition of Hollywood where, hey, you'll never enjoy a movie more than you will on the big screen. Of course, you're not seeing it again if you're in China because it set records the last time it opened there, but now it's open on a lot more screens and a lot more part of the country. So that's a billion people there who are getting their first great chance to see the movie.
Well, now you say a lot more screens. It opened on 180 screens back in 1998, and this time around, it's opened on 3,500 screens. So in China. Yes, correct. I'm sorry. Yes, I should clarify. In China, it opened on 180 screens in 1998 and now 3,500. But yeah, it's setting opening day records and opening weekend records in China.
Yeah, amazing. So that was the big news worldwide.
Can I just say, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but many of the...
Actually, you do mean to interrupt me.
I guess I do mean to. You know what? That's like, you know, the word of the weekend for me was sorry, which meant I just stepped on your face or I stepped on your foot or I pushed you aside and I mean sorry. Just that was my way of saying excuse me afterwards. With China, a lot of the exhibitors and distributors and equipment manufacturers over there who work in cinema say, you know, it's kind of a fuzzy box office system over there. It's, you know, $1 for you, Mr. Distributor, and $1 for me. $2 for you, Mr. Distributor, and $2 for me. So it's like this weird...
So it's honest to goodness, free-willing capitalism where corruption is rife.
Right, exactly. And so this is what's reported as having been made. Who knows how much it actually made? I mean, remember, this is a country where the top-rated television show gets 600 million viewers. So that's more people than live in the United States and North America.
I think the producers of American Idol just fainted. If you look at the total, Titanic has now made $202 million worldwide. That's more than all these recent 3D reissues like The Lion King, which tapped out at $178 million worldwide, and Star Wars, which made $100 million worldwide. So for a movie that costs $18 million to create this new print and convert to 3D, that's a tidy sum of money.
Yes, I think James Cameron right now, now that he's back up from the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the ocean, he's counting his money.
The number two movie at the box office worldwide is Battleship, the other film starring Taylor Kitsch that came out this year. It's made $58 million worldwide. It opened basically everywhere except in North America. It opens in the U.S. in May, but for a lot of reasons like competition between soccer, which they call football, and school, and a lot of other reasons, some Hollywood movies like to open before the summer season in Europe so they can get a lead on the other movies, make a lot of money. They're worried about it, though. They're opening it a month before it comes open in America, and they think somehow that that will make Americans feel like they're also-rans. But it opened number one in 20 territories. It opened about half as wide as Titanic is right now, as far as I can tell. So that means $58 million is a very strong opening. Taylor Kitsch, of course, had John Carter open, did pretty good business overseas. Not tremendous business, but good business. Now with this movie, even if it flops in the U.S., he's a movie star in the rest of the world.
Yeah, he can kind of wash the bad taste of John Carter out of his mouth. But since it's doing so well in the rest of the world, I guess I'm going to have to throw away all my headlines about You Sank My Battleship.
Exactly. The number three movie around the world is, in fact, Hunger Games. It made another $36 million worldwide. It's at $531 million and counting.
Wow.
Yes, so a big hit. Obviously, still bigger in North America than overseas, but overseas is nothing to sneeze at. And of course, the big news about The Hunger Games is that director Gary Ross will not be making the sequel.
Yeah, I mean, did you want to talk about that now or did you want to talk about that afterwards?
Well, we'll talk about it at the end, I guess. Number four around the world is Wrath of the Titans. It made $23 million. It's at $259 million and counting. And number five is the sequel to American Pie. This is American Reunion. It's doing a lot better overseas than any of the other American Pie movies. God knows why. But it made $22 million worldwide and said $80 million and counting.
I think I know why.
Why?
I think that the first movie came out in 1999, during the summer of 99. And I think DVDs were just coming onto the market, especially in Eastern European countries and in certain, Asia already had them. But so the DVDs have proliferated, and now there are more multiplexes than ever outside the U.S.
Oh, well, that's a true for box office in general, yes. But why this American Pie movie would do well at all overseas is really my head scratcher, I guess. But sure. Yeah, and just like Titanic today, you see it being reissued and doing so much better in China because there's so many more screens. So right. Fair enough. At number six worldwide is The Cabin in the Woods, the horror or sci-fi film. I'm not sure, still don't know what the trick is about this movie, but it opened to $18 million worldwide, mostly in North America and a little bit overseas. Not bad for a movie that's been sitting on the shelf for about 3 years. At number seven is The Three Stooges, a rebooting of the classic Three Stooges guys. It grossed $17 million, basically in North America only. And number eight is Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, the animated film, which is still chugging along. It made $11 million worldwide. It's at $278 million and counting. You know, now that it's slowing down, you can see that The Lorax did quite well in the U.S., but $300 million for an animated film isn't wildly great. You can see a lot of movies that did better, like Puss in Boots, but it only cost $70 million to make. So this is a very strong entry in what usually is a very expensive category. At number nine worldwide is 21 Jump Street. That made another $10 million. It's at $150 million and counting. And number 10 is the animated film from the Aardman people, the people who do Wallace and Gromit. The Pirates, Band of Misfits, grossed $8 million overseas, and it's at $44 million worldwide and counting, and it's opening up in North America any day now. At number 11 is another animated film, Huba, on the Trail of the Marsupilami. This is opened in France only. It's made $8 million this week and $21 million worldwide and counting.
I just hope this film stays on the list for weeks and weeks just so that I can hear you say marsupilami every week.
At number 12 worldwide is Mirror Mirror, the Julia Roberts movie. It grossed $7 million, basically in North America only. It's at $50 million. At number 13 is an opening film. This is Lockout, I should say, starring Guy Pearce. It's from Luc Besson, who I saw somebody write in one write-up. They said the film was by Besson, which would make it a very different film entirely. But it's by Luc Besson, B-E-S-S-O-N. It grossed $6 million worldwide, a very poor opening for that movie. And at number 14 is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, The film about elderly people moving to India to live on the cheap. It grossed $4 million, and it's at $61 million and counting.
And that film still hasn't opened in the U.S.
It's opening in May. We'll be fine. We're looking forward to it. At least my mom is. But that takes us back to The Hunger Games.
Yes, The Hunger Games, which, you know, just last week, we should talk about things on this show just so that they can be recanted or turned around as soon as we finish a recording.
Or we could just do a show every day.
That's true, because we were saying that just last week during our show, hey, they'll probably cut Lionsgate and Gary Ross. They're going to come to some agreement here on Catching Fire, the sequel to Hunger Games. And in fact, no, Gary Ross is not going to direct the sequel. He says that, you know what, and this is a quote from him, despite recent speculation in the media and after difficult but sincere consideration, I have decided not to direct Catching Fire. As a writer and a director, I simply don't have the time I need to write and prep the movie I would have wanted to make because of the fixed and tight production schedule. And I guess what he's alluding to there is...
Not alluding.
He's
referring directly to.
Referring directly to the fact that Jennifer Lawrence, the star of Hunger Games and, of course, Catching Fire, is, you know, she's going to be gone shooting the X-Men prequel sequel. And so she's not available.
Well, she's available, but she's available now.
Right.
They have to start filming in August and be done by December so that she can start in January shooting on the X-Men film. Now, the Fox might, in fact, push that forward or back. It probably won't, you know, necessarily be January, but they have her locked in and she's committed to that film first for various contractual reasons. So that meant they have to do this elaborate sequel to The Hunger Games. And of course, it was done a little bit on the cheap, as you can see if you see the movie, frankly. And they want to do the sequel. It's complicated. It's difficult. I think they should film both at the same time, personally. I don't know why they would do two and three separately. I know it's not the same setting per se, but I still think they should. Why wait? Why not film two and three together?
I know you're going to be making them. So why not just, you know, keep the crew up and running, get some really good deals on all of your equipment rental.
In which case you need all more prep time, in which case, you know, you don't want to rush it. You've got a valuable property here. Why you'd want to rush it and be done? Getting it ready for August is pretty tight. They don't have a script.
That's true.
You know, and it's all and the setting of the game is looks very different. So it's very different, very elaborate. It's very complicated. It's probably the most complicated of the three to film. So this is not the one you want to rush through. So frankly, Gary Ross is right. Whether it was an argument about money ultimately, or whether he said, you know what, we're having trouble coming to an agreement on how much money I get paid. Plus, you want to rush it out right now. You know, so that's not good. Frankly, though, he did a terrible job with the action. He may not be the best director for these movies anyway. So I don't know how much of a loss it is, but if I was Lionsgate, I'd want to keep him happy. I'd say, you know what? He's right. We need more time. Why rush it? Wait till after the X-Men is shot, and then we'll do it, you know, do both of them in a row. Get prepped, do both, save a little money that way, and then release them 1 year after each other, and everybody be happy.
Yeah, and, you know, at the very least, have him write the script.
If that's what he thought his best strength was, but, I mean, he may not be interested.
Yeah, I mean, he started out as a screenwriter.
I'm saying for this movie. Yeah,
oh, okay, you
know. Yeah. You know, again, if you want him available, why not make him available? It doesn't seem like a good idea to push this movie to August, no matter who's directing it. And maybe he's can step away. You know, maybe he felt a little shafted by the penny pinching on the first movie. There's some pretty lame effects in that first movie, frankly. Like the flaming costumes, I think, is a particularly embarrassing thing. I don't know why that looks so awful. But, you know, he did not get a ton of love for the movie.
You know,
it's done terrifically well. But people are still saying, I don't know if he can direct it. So the last thing he would want to do is be rushed into doing a sequel poorly. You know, he's made some very good movies like Seabiscuit and films well thought of like Pleasantville.
Yes.
So, you know, why get pushed into something that you know is not going to be up to whatever standards you want to reach?
Yeah, no. And he is very he's the kind of filmmaker and director that really only takes projects that he knows he can do a good job on and that he can take time to craft. He's known for that. So if to try and put him into a situation that he is uncomfortable in, it's just not going to work with that particular director. You might be able to do it with some filmmakers, but not this one.
Right, and that's what happened with the X-Men prequel, the first one, X-Men First Class. They were sort of on the fly the whole time with that, but it turned out great. People were happy with the cast. People were happy with the movie. It made a good amount of money. It rebooted the franchise creatively and to a degree commercially. So, you know, it can work out well when you're doing things in a moment of crisis, but it's not a really good recipe.
How do you like the name that I coined for that? Prequel sequel.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Well, now, in television news, You have been telling me for some time that Good Morning America may finally beat the Today Show. And these are two morning talk shows and news shows here in the U.S. One's on NBC, that's the Today Show. One's on ABC, that's Good Morning America. Both are long-running, but the Today Show has been number one for what, like 16 years?
Yeah, since December of 1995.
And it's won every single week in the ratings. And now, I guess, Good Morning America has beat it, at least for 1 week.
That's right. This is something that people have been writing about literally for a decade, waiting for this streak to end. So, and for years I was saying, it's not going to, until they get really close, there's nothing to write about. They're within 500,000, they're within 1 million, they're within, we've been narrowing the gap for about a decade now. So it's been a long time coming. They must have really popped the champagne corks over this one. What happened? Matt Lauer went on vacation. A week before this happened, we had Katie Couric, who was, of course, a longtime host of the Today Show, appearing on Good Morning America to plug her new talk show in the afternoon. In response, the Today Show booked Sarah Palin for one day. They had guest hosts. They had all sorts of stunts going on to sort of keep the attention. And they both fought it out, but Today Show remained triumphant. The following week, Matt Lauer went on vacation and Good Morning America won. Good Morning America had its regular hosts back in place. They had George Stephanopoulos and Robin Roberts. The Today Show only had Ann Curry, who's been on the show for a number of years, but is still sort of a new kid on the block as far as fans are concerned. She replaced Meredith Vieira, who was very, very popular. But apparently Matt Lauer is the secret ingredient here. He has been the face of the Today for so long now through Katie Couric, Meredith Vieira, and Ann Curry. He's the guy people link into. And, he just re-upped for another few years. Maybe he should have waited till after his vacation to re-up his contract.
Right. Well, I think he knew that. And that's why those contract negotiations were so hot and heavy and so contested. Well,
I don't know. They weren't contested at all. They basically offered him a blank check.
Oh,
they
really? I thought he was trying to get more money out of it.
No. They're like, whatever you want, baby. No, that show is incredibly profitable for them. No, it was not contentious at all. NBC was dying to have him. They weren't trying to save pennies. Not at all.
I thought they were throwing Ryan Seacrest around in his face, or at least the press was.
They had Ryan Seacrest on the show, which he joked about, but they always wanted Matt Lauer back. They didn't want him to think he was the only game in town. But no, there was never a question of them trying to nudge him down on the price or anything like that. They wanted him to sign. And the pressure of Ryan Seacrest, if it existed at all, was just to say, hey, we will sign somebody eventually if you don't want to do it. There will be other people who can do the show. It was just maybe pressure to him to sign if it existed at all. He was just booked on the show as a guest. People floated that idea. I don't even know if it was the Today Show people. But no, they always wanted Matt Lauer. They weren't trying to say, hey, kid, we don't need you. They're just saying, please, please sign and we'll give you whatever you want. A number one show for 852 weeks in a row, probably the longest streak in U.S. television history. And I like the quote from the Today Show producer. Did you see that?
I did see that. You have it here. Did you want me to read it? It says, today's 852-week winning streak had taken on a life of its own. And as odd as it is to see it end, we should acknowledge just how remarkable it has been. So as we tip our caps to the team at Good Morning America, we can also take a bow ourselves and recognize the work done by countless staffers for so long. It is not an overstatement to call it one of the most incredible achievements in television history, one that is not likely to ever happen again.
It's definitely a Joe DiMaggio-like streak. The question is, what happens next? Obviously, Matt Lauer has been re-signed, so NBC is happy about that. Ann Curry could perhaps look a little vulnerable. You don't like to make changes on morning shows, and they've been number one for a long time. And with Matt Lauer back in the seat next to Ann, they'll probably be number one again for, the new streak will begin tomorrow.
Right.
Did they send Meredith Vieira some flowers and candy to say, hey, we miss you and we love you? I wouldn't be surprised.
that's maybe. I guess we'll know in about 852 weeks.
And we should clarify, as far as finding new news that makes what we talk about seem outdated, Thursday is the day that the official final numbers come out. And Good Morning America only beat Today by about 13,000 viewers.
Wow.
I mean, if you and I had signed in and watched the show, Today's show might have kept their streak going. That's how tight it was. 13,000 viewer margin of error. So it is possible that both shows acknowledge that Good Morning America looks like it won. It is possible on Thursday we could find out that Today Show is still the champ.
Well, all I can say is that would actually, now that we've reported on it, then the Today Show will definitely win. Because You know, Gary Ross, we said, oh, he's going to direct the next, definitely, you know, they'll come to terms. And he decides not to direct it. Now that we said that Good Morning America beat the 852-week streak of the Today Show, now Good Morning America, I mean, the Today Show will actually win.
I thought we said they'd be smart to come to terms with Gary Ross. I didn't know that we insisted that they would.
No, but, you know, it makes a much better story this week if I say that.
Oh, okay. So you were at Coachella. You had a great time. Are you going to go back next weekend?
Well, you know, okay. So before we move on to music news, when we indeed, as Michael has kind of alluded to, tell you about all the hot acts that were there at the Coachella Music and Arts Festival, including one, by the way, who passed away over 10 years ago, yet still managed to show up on stage. By the way, Michael, how's that for a teaser before going to a sponsor break?
Great.
Well, our sponsor this week is us, in fact. We would like to remind you that you could email us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us. Our number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Please do write to us. We love getting your emails, and we read them on each show. And likewise with voicemails, we listen to them and play them when we get them. So please, we'd love to hear from you. Now, on to our music news. Yes, Coachella. So, Michael, what do you want to know?
I want to know what your favorite performance was.
Favorite performance? Wow. That's a good question. There were a lot of interesting performances and a lot of eyebrow raisers. Favorite performance, I would have to say, probably went to Fits in the Tantrums or Tune Yards. Certainly, Florence and the Machine, they just know what they're doing. I mean, they played Sunday night just before Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg came on. And, I mean, she's just a professional.
So it wasn't the two-hour Radiohead concert?
It wasn't the two-hour Radiohead concert, which was more like I guess it was about, you know, 1 hour, 40 minutes. Because they do have a time limit there. So Coachella, for those who don't know, it's a big music festival. It's much like Bonnaroo, much like Roskilde. It takes place over 3 days in India, which is a desert town outside of Los Angeles. Unlike most years, unlike every year that it's been in existence since 1999, they're doing 3 days, so Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, with a lineup, and then repeating the same lineup next weekend.
So, but I imagine you missed about a third of the acts. You could go back and catch everybody that you missed or revisit the acts that you really loved, whose sets would probably be a little different.
That's right. And in fact, 20% of the people who were there, and there's, you know, something like 140,000 people showed up this weekend, and, you know, they're coming back. 20% are going to both weekends, and it's not cheap. It's like $280, $300 per ticket, and they give you these wristbands to get in and out, and there's most, you know, 50% of the people camp. You know, I would say I was one of the older people there.
By a factor of 10?
No, but certainly I looked around and went, oh my God, I feel so old. You know, here I am in my 40s and all these kids jumping around in their 20s and, you know, like they didn't even card me to get into the beer garden. They were just like, you know.
Like, you can go in, buddy.
Yeah, I went all the way, you know, I had to bring my ID and I had forgotten it in my car, which is like 2 miles to the parking lot. So from the main gate, and I had to go all the way back, get the ID. I went up, the guy didn't even look at the ID. I said, don't you want to check my ID? He said, forget it, kid. You don't
move to the front of the line, pops.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh man.
So my other question is, did you discover any new act, somebody that you hadn't known before but or hadn't seen live and now were like became a fan?
Well, Pulp was great live. Of course, this is a band from the 90s that is reunited. They did a great set. I would say
climaxing I'm certain with Common People.
Yes, which is their big hit.
Yeah.
M83 is a kind of rocktronica band from France, I think. They were fantastic. They knocked it out of the park. And Tune Yards, which is kind of like one or two or three people, I couldn't figure it out. They have like a bass guitar keyboard player, and then their lead singer, drummer, you know, sequencer person. It's like electro rock. And that's really what most people were saying. I mean, if this doesn't sound like there's any running theme here, that's pretty much the case. And Randall Roberts, writing in the LA Times, said that Coachella 2012 was, quote, a visual and sonic mess that we can't resist, one with so many spoken and unspoken messages delivered in so many subgenres that you wonder how anyone in attendance can contain it all. Other than the simple two-word answer, you can't, Coachella's first two weekends offered a snapshot of pop music in wonderful, remarkable disarray. A Jackson Pollock of frequencies and angles, of offshoots, reflections, of 20-something musicians digging back to revive genres once thought extinct. I could not have summed it up better, because Fits in the Tantrums, I swear I was shocked to find out the lead singer was Caucasian. And it's like an old 60s soul act.
Yeah, they're a fun band. I've seen them live myself. I like them better live than on record. I don't think their original songs are quite up to their live performance yet, if that makes any sense. How can your live performance be better than the songs? But I think they are a really fun live act, and they got a lot of soul. I just don't think their originals are quite good enough yet.
Yeah, I mean, they have a couple of good songs, but they're, you know, it's interesting because they were put on the main stage early on Sunday, so like around 4 o'clock. Or 3 o'clock. And that's, you know, it's hot, it's sunny out, there's no lights to play with. And a lot of people came, and they knew that this was their moment. This was their big moment to really make a name for themselves. And they just were, they did not want to disappoint. They really put everything out there, and they knew it. They actually said that on stage, whereas Santigold, who, you know, made a big splash at a nighttime set several years ago at Coachella, she was put on before them and, you know, didn't really, she was very nice and, you know, adequate, but it just, something didn't click.
Well, it's a big stage, a big set. Sometimes you just don't, you know, the chemistry's not there.
Yeah. I mean, whereas like Gogo Bordello was put on that stage in years past. And like you say, they're better live than on record. And they just had the audience eating out of the palm of their hands.
What about First Aid Kit?
First Aid Kit is a sister duo act from
Sweden.
And they were on to talk about, you know, I could just hear the manager from Sweden going, oh, I got you a thing at Coachella, a gig at Coachella. They say, you know, 2:30 in the afternoon. Woohoo. Well, that was when everybody was arriving. And I had gotten there early just to see them. And they were really good. They sounded fantastic. And the audience knew, you know, it was very mellow. It's very kind of folky music. And it sounded great.
Cool.
But they're, you know, a YouTube act. They were kind of discovered on YouTube, as was Azealia Banks, both of whom were performing at this Coachella, one of the first to be broadcast live on YouTube.
Oh, the whole show was shown live on YouTube?
Well, specific sets were.
Of course, I thought the only place you would see Tupac would have been on YouTube, since he's been dead for a number of years, but apparently that's not the case.
Yes, you're giving away the big spoiler. So Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, I mean, Coachella has become kind of this place where they kind of invite one or two hip-hop acts to come. And this last year, it was what, Kanye West? The year before that, it was Jay-Z. This year, it was Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. And, you know, I wasn't necessarily all that excited to see them, but boy, did they put on a show. I mean, the production value from the very first second was amazing. And there were, I would say, about 60,000 people were on the field waiting for them. And the other 60,000 were heading out from having seen Florence and the Machine. And I heard one person say, oh, that was a good way to end it. And I thought, well, you know, there is one more act. And the 60,000 people that were leaving all stopped dead in their tracks when Dre and Snoop came on, because they really did put on a show. And one which included 50 Cent came out as a guest, Wiz Khalifa, or Wiz Khalifa, depending on how you pronounce it, Eminem, which that was widely expected, the Eminem. But what wasn't expected was, as you mentioned, Tupac Shakur showed up.
Via hologram, 3D hologram. How did it look?
It looked amazing, actually. It looked as if he were right there on stage, live. I mean, you could not tell the difference.
And how did they move around him? Was he just on his own in a corner, or
no?
What did
no,
it look
actually,
like?
Snoop Dogg did a little duet with him. I say that as if somehow he's Frank Sinatra. But he did stay off a little bit to the side, but a little bit behind him, and you didn't want the Tupac hologram, and it's not really a hologram, it's a projection. They spent like 4 to 6 months working on this effect that requires projectors and mirrors and Mylar screens, and it's phenomenal. And you don't want like Snoop Dogg to walk behind him, because then you'll actually be able to see through the image. So he kind of stayed off to the side, but it was pretty incredible. It was one of those moments that was jaw-dropping. And of course, it's what everybody's writing about the next day.
And so you can see this being used to have Elvis in concert, or Sinatra in concert, something like that?
Yes. Well, I don't necessarily know that because
people have paid money to go to Radio City Music Hall and watch an orchestra play music along with video projections of Frank Sinatra. So if they can have a 3D hologram, you know, why not?
Yeah. And, you know, it really the Black Keys played, Snoop Dogg and Dre played, you know, they were all the headliners, and the headliners were amazing, really sounded great. St. Vincent, on the other hand, you know, was poorly mixed, and you know, it's weird, this business of these festivals, because, you know, it used to be the Coachella moment where you have Girl Talk and everybody, you know, the DJ, everybody kind of dancing around to Girl Talk. That was the moment. You weren't going to get another moment like that. But now it's, well, until next weekend when he'll do it all over again.
You think that having a second weekend cheats people of feeling it's special?
I think, yeah. I mean, I think, you know what it does is it pulls back the fourth wall and it says, really, we're all in this for the money, which we all kind of know, but it was hidden before. It was, you know, the $9 beers.
But I mean, people go on tour, so that your special night in concert with somebody, they go in the next city and do the same show.
Right, but when you say, hey, I saw, you know, David Bowie play Radio City Music Hall in 73, you could say, okay, there was that show. It wasn't David Bowie playing Radio City Music Hall.
He does 10 nights sometimes.
I know, knew you were going to say
that. What's the difference?
I knew you were going to say
that. It's no difference. It's no big deal. But it doesn't ruin anything.
But this is, I mean, there is that weird moment of the Coachella moment. I mean, at one point, Fits and the Tantrums had everybody lying on the ground. And I thought, wow, what a unique moment. And yet now that same unique moment will happen again next week.
I laid on the ground at a Fits and the Tantrums show in the ballroom down in New York City.
Okay. Yes.
It's
yes.
Part of their show.
It's part of their show, but
it's like being upset. People did Rock Lobster all over the world.
Right. But I mean, I guess when you know, it's at this particular festival during this particular year. I guess that's what I'm.
Keep trying. Keep trying.
Okay.
Anyway, let's move
on.
Well,
speaking of us keeping trying, I have to say somebody was smart enough to put up a Twitter account, Hologram Tupac. Did you see some of these tweets?
Life is too short to read tweets from Hologram Tupac.
Me against the world of Warcraft. Anybody got a spare 54 AA size batteries? I think Snoop done smoked my charger. No. I mean, I think some of me, I wonder if I can give evidence in my own murder case. You know, that was kind of a little gallows humor there. Probably the best was, out of a job, anybody know how I can audition for the next Grand Theft Auto? That was probably the best. But you're right, Michael. We probably should move on to our guest, Doug Freeman, because I know a lot of the music that I heard at Coachella, I originally heard mostly either on Sirius XM or mostly from blogs. So M83, definitely blogs. Bon Iver, many, many years ago, who, by the way, was great at Coachella. I couldn't believe he commanded the main stage the way he did. Heard them all on blogs first. And there's been, a response to a Hypebot interview with Sean Adams, the founder of Drowned in Sound, which focused on the decline of MP3 blogging. And last week, Doug Freeman, a music critic for the Austin Chronicle and co-editor of the Austin Chronicle Music Anthology, wrote an opinion piece on Evolver.fm in response. And in his post, Freeman writes, and this is a quote, "The streaming playlister is the new music blogger to the extent that blogs were simply gateways to new music discovery." Doug Freeman joins us now from Austin. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate being here.
Now, you know, I liked this phrase playlister because, you know, I'm on Spotify and I can see that there are different people who have playlists, but how do you find a good playlist?
Yeah, it's an interesting problem. And that's part of the reason I wanted to write the piece was specifically, while I do see playlisters as usurping a lot of the blog's kind of filtering and discovery purpose these days, at least as far as streaming services are concerned, one of the things that you really don't get out of the playlister, if we're going to call them that, is that kind of editorial critique. And I'd really love to see streaming services facilitate that in some way to provide more context for what people are sharing, you know, whether it's through comments, user-generated, or top-down kind of editorial critiques. And we see a little bit of this happening and very rapidly, you know, say with Spotify apps and stuff like that. But that's really the big thing that's missing in the playlist.
Well, now let me ask you this. Let's actually take it back just a beat, because in the 70s, 80s, 60s, you know, really it was Rolling Stone magazine. There were certain editorial constraints around reporting on music. Then the internet kind of took off during the 90s, and here I'm telling people about the history of the internet, I suppose. But but the rock critic and the music critics kind of fell by the wayside as we entered the 2000s, and music bloggers took over. So what was the big difference there?
Well, I think the big difference is while music blogging certainly took over a lot of the cachet from your traditional kind of print music critics, one of the things that you really don't get from music blogs, again, are really deep diving criticism. They kind of took over the role, at least in my opinion, more of filtering and discovery, which was a very valuable role that, you know, the music critic had pretty much a dominant control over for many, many decades. And I think that's a great thing. And I think that music blogs do a great job of that. What we're seeing with the streaming services, I guess, is another shift to where now, you know, there's so much more access to so much more music that needs to be curated in some way, that needs to be discovered. And I think we're going to see a lot of that role of filtering and discovery shift over into the streaming platforms, whether it's happening within them or whether it's streaming directly with integrations like Facebook or Spotify's new play button and stuff like that.
So what happened in the old days was you'd read Rolling Stone and see a 4 or 4.5-star review or sometimes a 5-star review, and you'd rush out and buy an album. I did that with Rich and Linda Thompson. The first reason I bought them, it's not because I heard music on the radio, not because I listened to it online, because that wasn't possible. It was because I read a rave review of reissues of Richard and Linda Thompson in Rolling Stone, and that made me walk out to the store and buy an album. Then, of course, you had the bloggers, and they'd say, they didn't have to write about music. They could say, here it is. You can listen to the music right now. And so that's so much more satisfying than just reading about the music. But every new format creates a new style of presenting music to people, creates a new opportunity. So I guess we're going to see playlisters come up with creative, smart ways of presenting the world of music to people, both the history and current new music. What do you think is going to become the new way that they're going to, you know, play off this capability that they have to create an endless playlist of music? You know, what sort of creative impulses are they going to create? What we've seen is less and less criticism, less and less analysis and context, and just going, hey, here's a track. I heard this track, it's new, and everybody wanted to be first. Now we've got playlists, so every song in the world is available. You know, something's going to get inspired. Somebody's going to figure out a way to make this creative and interesting. I just don't know if we know what it is yet.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Michael. And I think it is a really interesting question that we are just now figuring out. And I would love to see both, you know, top bloggers and new folks that are working within this new format of streaming music to provide their discoveries, whether it's through playlists or through some kind of editorial function. We're just seeing that emerge, and it still has a long way to go. Nobody's figured out what that might look like. Again, I think like Spotify's apps are one interesting direction to go. I think integration of all music guides, kind of editorial and biographical information is incredibly valuable. You know, I would love to see streaming services be more progressive in opening up their platform to folks to play around with. And see what they can come up with. I don't think that anybody knows right now what that might look like in another year or 2 years. But I think we're going to see it very, very quickly. You know, we're already seeing it. But as far as like how it's going to congeal and what the new music blog might be within the streaming services format, you know, your guess and your speculation is as good as mine. But I'm excited to watch it happen over the next couple of years.
Could it be like going back to the radio DJ when they actually had control over their playlist? Could it be like a John Peel where basically you have a weekly playlist or a weekly podcast, if you want to think of it that way, where you get to play classic music and new music and present artists and talk about them and give people an hour or 2 hours a week where they know they're going to be introduced to some great new music?
Well, that's really my hope, is that in having a new format to play around with and a new function for the critic and for the blogger to investigate and evolve, you know, I really hope that we will get some kind of amalgam of the purpose and function that DJs served, the purpose and function that traditional critics served in providing that cultural context to music, and that discovery filtering in a very immediate way that we get from blogs. You know, I would love to see all those combine into something that is more comprehensive, and haven't seen anything like that yet.
Maybe Pitchfork.
But we're getting there, I think.
Maybe Pitchfork. I mean, they kind of, you know, they provide analysis. They have music, you know, good new music. That might be the exception, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think Pitchfork's app, I enjoy Pitchfork's app on Spotify a great deal, allowing me to listen to the music, you know, as I read the review and functions like that. For me, though, the main thing that streaming services need to provide is some kind of function also that allows for new music almost before it's been released to somehow be shared and played, especially if they're going to encroach on the music blogging space. You know, obviously the music has to be on the service for folks to stream it.
Right.
And that's the beauty of MP3 blogs and their kind of like sole domain that they have right now, is that they're getting a hold of the music before it's been officially released. And that's not through illegal leaks, you know, that's through PR folks and press, you know, so even legitimately they're discovering stuff as soon as it's, you know, hot off the digital press, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the Weeknd was, played Coachella, and everybody was curious because they were a big blog band. They broke, you know, via blogs, and I think they're out of the UK. But they were okay at Coachella. You know, I guess you really, a lot of people kind of walked away shrugging, going, okay, I get it. Interesting R&B act. But, you know, really, if it wasn't for blogs, who knows where they'd be? You know, and you look at services like Spotify, like Moog, like RDO, and you know, I've used all of them. They are kind of missing some kind of discovery tool. Now, Jimmy Iovine, he's of course the chairman of Interscope, Geffen, and A&M Records. He said, and this is a quote: "Right now, subscription music online is culturally inadequate. It needs feel. It needs culture. What Apple has in the downloading world is very, very good, but subscription has an enormous hole in it, and it's not satisfying right now." Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think it's a problem that the streaming services certainly recognize. I mean, Lord knows that they have enough problems on their hands, on the tech end and on the licensing end, that coming up with a good editorial and kind of cultural function is down on that list of to-do items. But they're reaching a point now where it's like they really do have to start focusing on that for the sake of their users, for user retention, and, you know, to keep bringing folks back and discovering new material. You know, Pandora has long had that kind of problem since it's completely discovery-based, and, you know, tweaking their algorithms. So it's something that I think that the streaming services are very much aware of and just now beginning to focus on. You know, we've seen a rise in, they've been called like musicologists, in a sense. You know, there's a panel at South by Southwest this year on the new musicologists and their role in music discovery and how they're kind of becoming the new editors and the new critics of the web, you know, whether it's through data and algorithms that they're helping set, you know, that includes everything from similar artists, you know, to opening up the platforms and you know, the kind of genome project stuff that Pandora is based off of, to actual criticism and more editorial critique, which I would love to see even more of, that you get from, say, like All Music Guide or something like that being integrated in.
Well, The Weeknd, by the way, is from Canada, Sperling. Is there anything that you're doing? You've got a full-time job, obviously, covering music. Is there anything you're playing with on the side? I imagine you've probably DJed some radio at some point, or maybe you've done podcasts, or is there anything you're playing with to trying to figure out, like, maybe what role you could do to sort of bring people to figure out what this new art form might be?
For me, I mean, specifically, no. I'm really curious in it. I don't have any projects in the work, or any startup ideas or anything like that. But I love talking to people about this, and I love playing around with it. So, you know, for example, you know, here in Austin, obviously, we have a lot of really talented bloggers, a lot of really talented folks in the music industry that are playing around with these new ideas and trying to figure out how to use them. A lot of that will depend on how much Spotify opens up their platform. And as I said, I would love to see them more versatile in that. And, you know, I don't know specifically what the answer might be, but I think that there is a huge opportunity there for folks that, you know, whether they were previously bloggers and taking that initiative to run those sites on their own, or that are new to the game and, you know, want to get in and have an impact. There's a lot of opportunity right now to define that new critical role and that new critical experience within the streaming services.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of the music blogger mystique, if you will, or agenda is to break new music, to become a kingmaker. I guess, as you mentioned, the whatever you're trying to break, whatever new band or new act you're trying to promote via a blog, if you tried to do it via Spotify or Ardio, that music has to be on there. So that's a bit of an issue. And you mentioned that you wanted to see Spotify open up their platform a bit. They do have this play button. I mean, what do you think of that? Because that really, I guess it's...
What is it?
Well, it's a button that allows any site, a blog or Tumblr, to play any of the songs that are on Spotify, an album, or even a whole playlist. And really, the button provides access to... It's really just a big hyperlink, in my opinion.
So it's like like embedding the YouTube video onto your blog?
No, because the YouTube video, you would never leave your blog to watch the YouTube video, whereas here you click the play button for a song on Spotify, and it launches Spotify, and it you have
So people have to have Spotify to use it.
Right, correct. And it's still free, mind you. It's still free, but you still have to download the app and have it on your computer, and it launches. It's kind of a little jarring at first. What did you think about that, Doug?
Well, there's actually a really interesting debate that has cropped up since they debuted that last week over whether artists should or shouldn't use this on their websites, which I think is a really valuable conversation to have. And I can see both the pros and the cons of it. The pros of it, you know, obviously any streams that do come from that, you are receiving that little minutia of royalties for.
Tenth of a penny.
Yeah.
but the major argument against it is you finally got a fan to your website where they're looking to interact with you in some way. They're looking to discover their music. I mean, that's kind of like step one, and it's the biggest barrier to overcome, and they are there. And so why do you want to give them over to Spotify at that point rather than, say, like, have them enter their email address and, you know, to get a download. And so now all of a sudden you have their contact information and you can build a relationship on top of that. I think those are really valid arguments. You know, Spotify's play button, I love the idea of, as a Spotify subscriber, you know, I love the idea of taking their music outside of their platform specifically. But when I say opening up their platform, in my mind, I would like to see them open it up not to spread it across the web, but to allow people to do more things on top of it. So allow folks to upload their own music, you know, to upload new tracks to Spotify so that they are available through this. Right now, that's a barrier for them, understandably, because it raises a whole nother set of issues that you see a lot of services dealing with when folks are allowed to upload their own stuff. But it would be really nice to see them develop something along those lines that allow people to share their own work more easily, allow artists to upload tracks and like have those out there.
So kind of like SoundCloud does. I mean, they allow embeds and you can upload your own music and allow for downloads or not allow downloads. And I guess really the question is, do people want to own music or do they just want to rent it? Because that's, you know, MP3 blogs and music blogs, you get to download the music.
I mean, I'm old school and I love that kind of like ownership of it. You know, I have a ton of LPs and I have more CDs than Lord knows what I can do with right now. And I love those things, but you also have to acknowledge, I think, and it breaks my heart being the kind of music materialist that I am, that it really is about access and about playing and hearing. And that's how most folks are happy to consume the music experience. And I love Spotify for those reasons. I love having access to, you know, that infinite catalog of albums. Say, like, even as a music critic, if I'm researching an artist, I have all their music here, ideally, at my fingertips, and I can dive into it without having to search around for it, without having to go out and buy their catalog, without having to hit up a publicist to get that music. So it's incredibly valuable, and I think it all comes back to the experience of it. Obviously, the material aspect of LPs or CDs, and you know, even to a certain degree, downloads, carries an experience along with it. So now it's up to these streaming services to define a really great experience for users that keeps bringing them back. And I think that a major role in doing that has to be the editorial value that they're providing, both in the discovery sense and in just the pure information context sense.
Well, maybe what we need is a hype machine, which is a blog, music blog aggregator, a hype machine for playlisters, which I think is a good term that I'm going to give you credit for coining. But, you know, maybe we need a playlister aggregator. That's a tongue twister.
Well, I mean, just as far as like playlists are concerned, I think that we will see folks rise to the top. I mean, there have been some of my friends who don't have music blogs that I've discovered through Spotify's Facebook integrations, but whose musical taste, you know, is great. And I love seeing them curate playlists, and I trust them, and, you know, I listen to their playlists all the time. It's still a little clunky as far as discovering new playlists. You kind of have to know what you're looking for. But even in Spotify's search engine, you know, if you're searching for a band or a song, you know, it does actually bring up publicly shared playlists.
Yeah, I know. I saw that.
So that element is getting there. And I think that we will see people that are not branded. Like right now, I can go to the stuff that say like Drowned in Sound or Gorilla versus Bear, or one of my favorite Alston blogs, Side One Track One. You know, they all have playlists up on Spotify of the stuff that they're sharing. And I know to seek them out. And because they're branded from their blogs, you know, I trust them already. Who might emerge as somebody that doesn't bring that already branded cachet and be like, hey, this person is a great Spotify playlister. You know, they're putting up new stuff. They're discovering old stuff. You know, that's what I'm really excited about, is seeing what kind of stuff that Spotify has in its catalog that I've never heard, you know, whether it's from 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, all these lost gems that are sitting there. I think there's a real opportunity for people to curate that. So I think that those people will emerge, and I think that they will be celebrated, and you'll all of a sudden see folks that all have, you know, hundreds of thousands of subscribers on Spotify when it reaches that kind of impact, you know, to a playlist and folks following when they update that playlist with new material.
Well, finally, I mean, for those who are more traditionalist or semi-traditionalist and might be listening to this and thinking, well, I was just about to start my music blog. Have I missed the boat? I mean, do you think it's too late to start a music blog, or is it just you have to start a Spotify playlist?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, I would say if you want to start a music blog, by all means, that's the beauty of what blogging did, was it was open to everybody. I think if you're serious about starting a music blog, especially in any sense of making it successful beyond just a local or personal sharing ability, you have to take Spotify and the other streaming services into consideration in your plan for domination.
Spotify, yeah, world domination via Spotify. That's a new use for the service I hadn't thought of before.
We're still a ways away from that, but I'll be curious to see who that person was. You know, at the end of the piece that I wrote for Revolver FM, you know, I asked who will be the John Peel and the Lester Bangs and the Sean Adams of this new format, and somebody's going to emerge with something, and I hope that Spotify and the other streaming services are open enough to allow that person to be what they're going to be and allow that innovation to happen.
Well, let's hope you're right about that. Doug Freeman is a music critic for the Austin Chronicle and co-editor of the Austin Chronicle Music Anthology. Doug, thank you for joining us.
Thank y'all for having me on. It's a real pleasure.
Now, you can be followed at DM Freeman on Twitter.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you.
Well, that was good of him to join us. You know, I lived in Champaign, Illinois for a year and a half, and I had a weekly radio show, and I had so much fun doing that. It was like 2 to 3 hours in the middle of the night. I could do whatever I wanted. I just was a free form. I'd pick a topic like rain or death or something and just play music from as many different genres as possible, including new music, but like pop, jazz, country, soul, Broadway, you name it. And it was so much fun, and that's still sort of my dream. But I guess radio is like so 1990s. I mean, you know, podcasts are old school by now.
No, 1930s is radio.
Yeah.
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 Do we want to cover this stuff about Jeff Tweedy and Wilco and their experiment with concert ticket pricing?
I don't think it's really an experiment. All they're doing is they're trying to raise money for a museum, and they're having a concert. And instead of just naming a ticket price and selling them to people, they're letting people name their own price and encouraging them to make it as high as possible so that they can benefit the museum. So it's just, you know, you can guarantee access if you bid enough money for their ticket. And then they have a lottery system. So it's for people who didn't get through that first round. But it's not really a new model for selling concert tickets. It's just a way to raise as much money as possible for the people that they're trying to benefit.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm always, as you know, very interested in the concert ticketing venue. No pun intended.
Then I'm sure you read about the Live Nation kickbacks.
Yes. Now, and I especially read about it because that's my old stomping grounds, New Jersey and the Meadowlands. The New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority, which actually owns and runs the Meadowlands, which is where Giant Stadium used to be, which I know is no longer called Giant Stadium, and the Brendan Byrne Arena used to be and is no longer called the Brendan Byrne Arena, mainly because they've torn all of those down and rebuilt them. It turns out that they were giving kickbacks to Live Nation so that Live Nation, the big concert promoter, would bring concerts to those venues.
I mean, I don't know why they had to do it in a secret kickback. Why not just arrange some, you know, public, straightforward, hey, you know, we want you to bring us more business and you'll get a bigger cut of the gate or whatever it is when you come, you know? Like, why would they have to do a kickback? Where they had to sort of slide, this is according to the Star Ledger in New Jersey.
Right.
They say that Live Nation and the New Jersey Sports and Exposition Authority worked on a sliding scale per ticket rebate, meaning that the more concerts they did, the more bigger rebate they got on each ticket sold, and they'd get like $4 to $6 a ticket. Well, you know, all right, why not just
and the they in this case is Live Nation. The more concerts Live Nation did, the bigger the kickback. Live Nation was collecting, as you say, $4 to $6 per ticket.
Right. But why not just give them a bigger cut of the gate in general? I mean, I don't understand why it had to be some secret kickback thing.
Yeah, I didn't understand that either. So, and apparently there were other promoters involved in this, but not to the tune of $2.9 million. You know, there was $30,000 here, $200,000 there. So it seems like it's kind of an ongoing industry practice. But
and what do you do with a secret kickback when you're Live Nation?
Like, I know.
Does that just become the party fund, or what do you do with it? I mean, do you put it on the books?
Well, you probably do, but under you know, account, not a secret account, but you know, under an account that it has to do with that particular venue.
So they're grafting kickbacks in the music industry. Is that a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop since we all kind of knew that to begin with. Don't you think?
Yep.
Well, you know what? Since you brought up big deals and big whoops, you know, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment, and we tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, we told you last week that HBO's Game of Thrones opened season 2 to record ratings for the fantasy series. You won't be surprised that HBO has renewed it for a third season, but buried in the announcement were some fascinating facts about how the series will unfold. The show is always a tremendous roll of the dice, that's for sure. It's based on a 7-book series with the 2 final books not even written yet. At the very least, it looked like audiences would have to wait to the end of the 7th season to reach the conclusion of the story, making Game of Thrones the biggest miniseries in history. Very few shows last 7 seasons, and this one will end with a cliffhanger if it doesn't get there. Forget 7 seasons, okay? Because HBO just acknowledged that a 10-episode season isn't enough to do justice to book 3. So they'll take at least 2 seasons to capture all the story in that volume. Did you get that? They'll take at least 2 seasons or 20 episodes to tell the story of each new volume. That means Game of Thrones just jumped. Hold on, I'm doing my math. Carry the 1. 7 seasons to 12 seasons before it gets to the end of the tale. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a very big deal because the show focuses a lot on these young actors. These kids are teenagers. And the story takes place over like 4 years, but they're going to have like 12 or 14 years before the show is done filming the way they're going. And that means they'd be like in their late 20s or 30. So I'm not quite sure how they're going to deal with this.
So, you know, it'll look just like 90210, all like 40-year-olds playing high school kids.
Right, they're supposed to still be in high school. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what they're going to do. Maybe they'll adjust the story and extend the time frame. But it's fascinating. But it's a, you know, they did the right thing. You can't tell these stories in 10 episodes and do it any justice. They're so lengthy and so elaborate. I wonder if they're going to just lengthen the seasons maybe sometimes, or do 10 in the spring and 10 in the fall, because I don't think they want to wait 12 years to finish filming the show. I don't think that'll work. So it'll be interesting to see what they do.
I agree. Jews everywhere celebrated last week, and not just Passover, by the way, but the fact that Mel Gibson's movie about the famed Jewish hero Maccabee, we've talked about it here on the show, well, it's been scotched by Warner Brothers. The cancellation sparked an angry exchange of public charges with Esterhaus, that's Joe Esterhaus, the screenwriter, writing a lengthy j'accuse against Mel Gibson that called him an anti-Semite and an anger-filled madman, among many, many, many 9 pages of claims. Gibson responded that if he was such a nutter, why did Joe Esterhaus stay with the project all this time instead of bow out like any honorable person would have? Hollywood stood back and chuckled, and Warner Brothers sighed with a, you know, relief, probably. A big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop, you know? Joe Esterhaus has always been a cranky, ornery guy, though I like him because he answers his own phone. So he's a fun guy. You can get him on the phone when you're trying to reach him.
Unfortunately or unfortunately, and he's usually, what are you on?
Mel Gibson's rejoinder was great, though. Mel Gibson suddenly seemed like the reasonable guy in this debate when he said, well, if I was such an ugly, vicious anti-Semite, why did you stay on the project?
Right.
Until you were fired. So suddenly he looks sane. So that was sort of the crazy mirror part of this story.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, this project falls apart. Big deal. Mel Gibson could still film it on his own if he chose. He's got the money. So we'll have to see. I don't know if this is the end of Maccabee.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think, you know, for those of you who don't know who Joe Esterhaus is, he is the screenwriter behind Basic Instinct and, of course, the filmmaker behind the wonderful Showgirls.
Well, he didn't film it. He wrote the screenplay.
Right. Unless you count showing up hours late and giving a half-assed performance most of the time, singer Axl Rose just did the most rock and roll gesture in many, many years. Rose still tours now as Guns N' Roses, as we've talked about here, but he didn't show up at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony or reunite with Slash and the other original members of Guns N' Roses for a performance when the band was inducted into the Hall of Fame. Rose didn't quite diss the whole idea of the hall. In a lengthy letter to the LA Times, he said he was honored to be nominated, but had personal issues with all those other guys and wasn't feeling it. So Slash performed with a guest vocalist and Rose stayed home. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. They got inducted anyway. He said, nobody can induct me. Don't induct me. I won't be inducted. Well, you're inducted.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Now, speaking of people who show up late, you wanted to know one of the best acts? The electronica group Justice. It's 2 DJs. They were fantastic. 30 minutes late to their set right before Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg, but unbelievable.
Ouch.
I have no idea why they were late. It may have been some technical reasons, but they are well worth seeing and, you know, quite the show.
I'll keep them in mind.
Actress Kim Novak said she felt raped after the Oscar-winning film The Artist used chunks of the score from Vertigo in a crucial scene. Now, you would expect the next sentence in this story to be, and then somebody sat Kim Novak down to explain what rape meant, the definition of rape. But anyway, I wonder how she felt at the TCM Classic Film Festival. The TCM Fest, of course, is a huge event here in LA with pricey tickets, great venues, and what should be beautifully presented prints of great movies. However, in the case of Vertigo, they projected a DCP, or digital cinema package, essentially a digital copy of the movie. Unfortunately, technology is only so good as the care taken with it, and this copy of Vertigo was apparently a washed-out mess that would have made a VHS tape look good in comparison. People literally were walking out in disgust. Big deal or big whoop?
What's a big whoop in the scheme of things? It's embarrassing for Turner Classic Movies, which is a great channel. I love it. And they do this festival every year in LA. I wish they would bring it to New York and duplicate it because it seems like a lot of fun. And they had a lot of good different things that they presented. And it helps bring about film preservation and stuff like that. Nothing wrong with using DCP. I mean, a lot of movies that you see today are digital projections. And of course, they're a lot cheaper than prints, right, Sperling?
Oh, they're much cheaper than prints. I mean, certainly you have to get a digital cinema master the same way you'd have to get, you know, a release print made or a release negative struck so that you could make release prints. And, you know, usually you're distributing a film on 3,500 screens, you release print, each new print that goes to a theater is about, you know, $1,200, give or take. But getting there, getting to that point is, it, you know, costs a fortune. You're going through, you know, inner negatives, etc. DCPs. Now, this is what's interesting to me about this, Michael. A DCP, as you say, digital cinema package. It's like saying we're going to, you know, that a film is the film can, because all a DCP is the wrapper around. It's just a wrapper around the file. That's it.
Well, it's a digital copy, right?
It's a digital. It's basically a digital print. File, yeah. And the DCP is the security wrapper around it. It's like saying I got a manila envelope today instead of saying I got a letter today.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, it's just a weird way of kind of.
A DCP is a digital print of a digital file of a movie instead of a physical negative.
Right. It's the container, though.
What do you mean it's just the container?
Well, it's very technical. Basically, a digital.
When they send a DCP to a theater, it includes the film.
Right. Or it could just include a portion of the film. It could be a supplemental package. It could just include the audio tracks, because all a DCP is the envelope. It's just a container.
It's like saying a CD is just a CD. It's a blank thing with the information on it, whatever you want to include on it, right?
Yes.
Or an MP3. It could be one track or the entire album. The DCP is either the audio or the entire film.
Right, but when you say, I bought Madonna's new CD, you know what we're referring to. When you say...
Well, I sent a copy of Vertigo to the theater in a DCP, you know what they're talking about.
Yes. It's just weird to me after, you know, 10 years of dealing with DCI or Digital Cinema Initiative specifications and standards to see something that was so technical, DCP, which is like the film canister, if you will, be referred to as the entire piece.
So the point here is that it's only as good as the care you take with it. Like CDs, people hated at first because they sounded terrible because they were poorly mastered. You have to do a good job of mastering. CD can provide great sound, though not good enough to satisfy Neil Young. But you have to do a good job. And today, most CDs, you're going to hear a really good job because people know how to master them now.
Right.
And same thing with DCPs. You can create a good digital file of a movie, even a great file, but you have to take care and have a good print or something that you're working from in order to create that file. In this case, for Vertigo, they did a terrible job by drawing on some substandard source.
That's right. And the same was true of Blu-rays when they first started. They would just take the standard definition master and try and turn it into a Blu-ray, and they looked awful. Probably the biggest one was The Fugitive was the one that kind of is used as the best example of it. And I saw a 4K restoration of The Godfather in digital. It was a digital print. And first scene, very grainy. And I thought, well, that's what, you know, Coppola was there. And he said it's meant to look grainy. The second that they cut to the outside wedding scene, mm-hmm. It looked like they were streaming it over YouTube. And I got up and walked out. Like half the audience got up and walked out. That's how bad it looked.
When was this?
This was 3-4 years ago. So, you know, they've gotten much better since then, but still, it did not look good. And you're right, you do have to take care with it. Hey, here's one that's somewhat Coachella-related. David Byrne has collaborated on theatrical productions before, most notably The Civil Wars with director Robert Wilson. But now he's got an honest-to-goodness musical in the works. Byrne, and get this, Fatboy Slim will present Here Lies Love at the Public Theater in New York in April of next year. It's a musical about Imelda Marcos of the Philippines and includes songs Byrne has recorded and released in 2010, along with some other tracks. Now, what rhymes with shoes? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop. I'm not really feeling this as a fascinating project. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm curious. But the songs didn't blow me away. I don't feel them as being particularly theatrical. But we'll have to see. As far as what rhymes with shoes, there's booze and lose and I've paid my dues. So I think this should be easy to do.
You should be a songwriter. Speaking of which, St. Vincent, who was at Coachella, is cutting an album with David Byrne.
Cutting an album with, or he's producing them, or
no, cutting an album with him, and they're going on tour together.
Oh, that's interesting.
Should be interesting. Maybe her sound mix will get better. Who knows? Hey, AMC is staying in business with Robert Kirkman, the creator of the comic book that inspired the channel's biggest hit, The Walking Dead. They've optioned his newest comic book series and plan to turn it into a show as well. It's called Thief of Thieves. It's about a master thief who only steals items that have already been stolen. Unlike The Walking Dead, Thief of Thieves is brand new. Its third issue just came out, so there's no map for the series the way they have with their zombie show, The Walking Dead. Is Thief of Thieves a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I think unless it was a really bizarre concept, I think anything that Robert Kirkman came up with was going to be something people were interested in doing, because The Walking Dead is proving such a monster hit. It's kind of a fun comic book concept. What's really neat about this is that he created the comic book inspired by the way the show is done. You know, the show, of course, you have a team of writers working on a particular vision. And for his new comic book, rather controversially in the comic book world, instead of writing it all himself or with one other person and having an illustrator do it, he is working with a team of writers. So he came up with the concept, came up with the overall arc. He's got a team of writers, just like you do on a TV show, developing scripts for individual, you know, episodes or individual issues. And that's how he's putting this comic book out. So it's kind of a weird back and forth influence on each other. So it'll be fun to see how it turns out.
You know, classic albums have been turned into Broadway shows and they've been turned into movies. But usually, you know, those albums are concept albums like Pink Floyd's The Wall, The Who's Tommy, and Green Day's American Idiot. Well, now Hollywood is digging even deeper. Last week, a producer announced that they had optioned Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks, an album about the disintegration of a relationship. And now NWA's Straight Outta Compton is serving as the basis for a biopic about the famed rap group. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, I think. I'm not sure if they have the rights to use the actual music from Blood on the Tracks, I assume. Why else would you option it? It doesn't seem like there's enough of a script there that you would want to option it unless you got the music. And Straight Outta Compton, I think, is more just they're using the name of one of their classic albums as a link to tell the story of the band. Obviously, their music will be in the movie.
Yeah.
It's a, you know, they're fun projects. The Blood on the Tracks is weird, frankly.
I don't see it, but we'll see.
but it's a great, great album. And Straight Outta Compton, people want to see the NWA story. That'll be fascinating to see how far they take it.
Yeah. Maybe they could cast a holographic Tupac.
That's right.
One of the members of Penn & Teller is suing a fellow magician for copying a famed magic troupe of his and offering to sell the secret for $3,050 via a YouTube video. I think it was more like $3,049.99. Raymond Teller of Penn & Teller has been performing an illusion called Shadows for decades and even copyrighted it in 1983. The illusion involves a rose in a vase with its shadow projected on a screen. Teller cuts the shadow petals one by one, and the real petals on the real rose fall off at precisely the same moment. Dutch entertainer Gerard Doge, is that how you pronounce it?
I don't know.
Posted a YouTube video of an illusion he called The Rose and Her Shadow. Acknowledges it is his version of the Teller illusion and offered to sell the secret. Teller heard about it, sent a takedown order to YouTube, and then called Dog, I don't know how you pronounce his name, to offer a sum of money not to reveal the secret. Doge asked for much more money. Teller refused, and now he's suing. Of course, he has to do it all silently. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Is Teller the quiet one?
Yes, that's the joke. Penn is the talkative one, and Teller never speaks.
You're right. Yeah, I've interviewed Penn, but not Teller, of course. I think it's a big deal because it's a fascinating copyright issue. It's really hard to copyright magic tricks, apparently, just like it's hard to copyright choreography. And of course, most magicians don't go to the bother of doing what he did, which is to actually register it as, you know, copyright it formally like he did. And of course, magic has a long history where people build on the tricks of other people. They either take a trick you do and put a variation on it, or they just duplicate it. You know, figuring out how to do it on their own is a challenge. And they want to, hey, you cut a woman in half. I want to cut a woman in half. So it's a really tricky and interesting case. He's got a lot of documentation for it, and it'll be fascinating to see what happens to it.
In a wide-ranging interview with UK paper The Guardian, musician Damon Albarn laid to rest a number of ghosts. Yes. He was really sidetracked by heroin for a while, though it did open him up artistically. So apparently does ecstasy, according to the 140,000 people I was with over the weekend. Yes, Blur is recording a new song for the Olympics and performing at the closing ceremonies, but that's probably the end of it for the band that made his name. And no, even Gorillaz, his most successful side project, probably isn't coming alive again anytime soon because it's run its course. So fans of Albarn will simply have to stay on the ball and keep track of all his various groups like Rocket Juice and the Moon, his opera Dr. D, and so on. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Kind of a big deal for me. It's the end of an era. I mean, Blur broke up, but then they kept reuniting for shows, and they did a song here and a song there. So you kept thinking they might do an album. It's kind of sad to hear that, you know, no. I think there's still hope someday, but it clearly feels like he's not feeling it with all four guys anymore. Gorillaz, I'm even more surprised by. I did feel the last album was a little disconnected and they weren't quite on the same page. So I'm not quite surprised by that. But, you know, this guy's always had a bunch of different monikers, a bunch of different bands and names that he's been playing with. So, you know, just put them all under A for Albarn and focus it on that way.
Yeah, and I'm glad I saw the Gorillaz perform live at Coachella a couple years ago. That was actually one of the best sets that year.
Cool.
George Lucas. Well, after 25 years battling with the residents of a bedside community in Marin County, Lucasfilm is officially dropping any attempt to get permits to build a 269,000-square-foot facility. Now, why did they take so long to throw in the towel? Maybe the fact that the area was coincidentally named Lucas Valley was too good to resist. In any case, a Lucas spokesperson said, enough is enough. Local residents couldn't agree more. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big whoop, as Karen would say, studio doesn't get built. However, I do think the idea after 25 years, like, well, lots of other people want us to build this facility. Like, okay, so why were you trying to go in an area where they didn't want a big, huge business built up? You know, it's a bedside community with people commuting. Well, you know, if, I'm sure there are places that want to have a film studio built in their backyard. Why not? You know, it's a, probably a good business. So, you know, why have they been fighting for so long? I don't quite understand this.
Hey, Michael, remember when the History Channel was so focused on World War II that people called it the Hitler Channel?
Jawohl.
If you miss those days, don't fret, because a new website is launching just for you, just for Michael Giltz, called America's Wars. It features hundreds of hours of documentaries that can't be found on Netflix or Hulu. They're all about war, war, and more war. It costs $5 a month and currently offers 250 hours of programming. You can stream with more on the way. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop.
I think that's all that needs to be said.
I'm reading a book on World War II right now by Anthony Beaver, the British historian. I think he's British. 250 hours of programming. Boy, that's an awfully small amount of programming, isn't it?
Well, it's probably all they could get for right now.
Right. But I mean, this is we've had problems with other people launching these websites where they think people are going to subscribe to them monthly to get access to their service. You know what? It's like, sorry, you know, you want to be on something like Netflix or some big site where they offer tens or hundreds of thousands of different hours of programming. You can't get people to pay $5 to access your tiny little sliver of stuff. It's a very small business at best. I don't think the programming is up to snuff. It's just it's not a good idea.
Yeah. As you were saying all that, I was thinking, why am I defending this thing?
Yeah.
Anyway,
so, I mean, you're going to have people who really want to watch skateboarding videos or really going to watch something else obscure and little, but getting them all to subscribe to it for a monthly fee is really pushing it.
Fans of Downton Abbey, brace yourselves. Maggie Smith says that after the third season of the show and a Christmas special, she's going to walk away from the hit TV series.
What?
Yes, the Daily Mail quotes a source claiming that Smith believes, quote, 3 seasons is enough, end quote. Plus, she wants to get back to other stage and screen work. This could make for a very sad Christmas, since it's likely they would kill Lady Violet off. On the other hand, why not send her off to a warmer climate, say the best exotic marigold hotel in India? Then Lady Violet could swoop in once or twice, you know, once or twice more before the show ends. Big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's sort of a big whoop and a big deal. The producers of the show immediately countered, and, you know, this was a quote of an anonymous source in the Daily Mail. Never trust the British press.
We all know how accurate those are.
And the LA Times spoke to a producer of the show, and they said, there's no truth to this. However, virtually everybody else has signed their contract for seasons 4 and 5 and beyond. Maggie Smith has not. So the producer of the show didn't counter by saying, there's no truth to this. In fact, we've signed her for seasons 4 and 5. No, no, no. She just said, there's no truth to it. She's filming season 3, so shut up.
Right.
And we don't reveal future plot points, so just behave yourselves. And she's staying with the show, and we love her, though she's a pain in the neck. She actually did say that. So I think there's still a kernel of truth here.
But don't you think the pain in the neck thing was just a joke?
No, 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 no. Maggie Smith is a handful.
Oh, okay.
No, Maggie Smith wants things done her way. And she's not going to suffer fools gladly. No, I don't think that was a joke at all. No, okay. She's saying, you know, she can be difficult on the set, but she's a wonderful actress and star, and she always delivers, and we'll do whatever we can to make her happy.
Well, maybe no. She can star in Downton 6B, which was the Jimmy Fallon kind of take on it. It was a hilarious little send-up of...
Hilarious?
Well, funny.
Funny?
Too long, but funny.
Did you smile momentarily? That's as much as I would ever expect from Jimmy Fallon.
Actually, you should watch it. It's actually pretty good. Good news for the publishing industry. J.K. Rowling's new book now has a release date.
It's, huzzah!
I don't even know what that means, but it's titled The Casual Vacancy and comes out on September 27th. An official description says the book is about a seemingly placid English village called Pagford, in which unrest is bubbling under the surface. Has any book for adults ever been more anticipated by kids in history? And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. All we got was a release date. We knew it was coming out in the fall, but it's every little bit of good news for the publishing industry is welcome.
That's true. Now, speaking of good news for the publishing industry, maybe we should move on to Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, guess what we get to talk about? Now, we've reported on this in the past. We've told you this was coming. Everybody knew this was coming.
Now it came.
Now it's here. The Justice Department of the United States, DOJ, as it's sometimes referred to, has sued Apple and several large publishers for collusion in an antitrust lawsuit. Now, this is not about necessarily the agency model, where the seller, in this case Apple, gets 30% of the price of a book, rather than being sold the book wholesale and then taking their cut. It's about the collusion.
Well, yes, but in fact, part of the settlement is that they do have to drop the agency model.
That's correct. Yeah, well, I think for a certain period of time, for like two to five years.
Well, that's forever.
Yeah. In the publishing industry, in this day and age where, you know, 5 years ago, there was no iPhone and now there's Kindles. So, yeah, I would agree with you that 2 to 5 years, that's forever.
Yeah. So the Department of Justice officially brought suit against five publishers, three of whom settled right away. Three of them agreed to dump the agency model and they agreed to do other things. Macmillan and Penguin, however, are going forward and fighting the charges. They say they've done nothing wrong. There's two issues here. One is the pricing of books and how that's handled. And the other one is this collusion. It seems like that they all met in a room, according to the Department of Justice, and got together and said, what are we going to do about this darn Amazon? And Apple said, hey, why don't you do it this way and do pricing this way? And then we'll force Amazon to have to match that price. And they said, okay. And that would, of course, be collusion. And we speak, of course, as completely untrained lawyers.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right. And whenever I attend, you know, we're talking about DCPs earlier. Whenever I attend a digital cinema trade group meeting or a standards or specifications meeting, there are several manufacturers and studios and people, you know, exhibitors. And the very first thing that is said in the room is that nobody can set prices. It is not the antitrust warning is read verbatim.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So assuming those charges are true, that would be perhaps an example of collusion, and that's why they have grounds for this. What's upsetting is that the publishing industry sees Amazon driving bookstores out of business with their practices, undercutting competitors, selling books for less than cost, driving everybody out of business to where they'll be the last man standing, which is exactly what happened with music, where music, you know, all the big music chains are gone. And they're worried that that's going to happen. The number two bookstore chain has collapsed. The number one Barnes & Noble is not going to be around in its same way, shape, or form in 5 years from now. There's no way, not with half of their business going to be digital. Even if they keep that business, they can't keep all those stores around. And Amazon is undercutting everybody. They're charging money for books less than what they pay for. They're loaning books as library books to people who buy a Kindle, and they pay as if the person bought the book. They pay the publisher as if the person bought the book when they rent it. They just borrow it for free. So it's a big problem, and all the publishers are upset at the Department of Justice. But in fact, if there was collusion, they had the right and the obligation to act, regardless of what's happening to the industry. They're not there to make sure Amazon plays smart or fair, or, you know, smart. They're just there to make sure everybody's following the law. And in this case, it seems like they may not have been.
Yeah, I mean, if only like one of the publishers, let's say Random House, had gone and said
that was not one of the ones named.
Yes, I know. They're the only ones who actually didn't go to the agency model until much, much later. So let's say Simon and Schuster went out and said, we're going to the agency model. And then Hachette, also named, they said, you know,
would have followed suit.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea. Let's do that. And HarperCollins came in a week later and said, hey, that's actually, they're getting away with it. We want to do it too. That's the way airlines set their pricing. One airline drops their price. 2-3 days later, all airlines drop their prices.
I still find that suspicious because my airline price is the same down to the penny. Right. You know, when I'm booking a flight to London, same to the penny. Really? Don't tell me there's not collusion going on. Some de facto collusion is going on there. But to explain again what we're talking about, Traditionally, publishers sell a book for, say, $10 to a bookstore, and the bookstore sells it for whatever it wants.
They could sell it for $9 and lose a dollar. They could sell it for $50 and make 40. Usually, right. They sell it to, you know, that it's marked down at $24.95, and then they'll like, oh, 30% off because they've only paid $10 for it anyway.
Or $12 or whatever it might be. So there is a list price on the book, but it's a suggested price, and stores are not obligated to follow that. The agency model is that the publisher sets a price, and then the seller gets 30% of the profits. So the publisher can say $15, $10, $20, whatever that price is, then Amazon or Apple or the bookstore gets 30% of that price. That's the model that they were trying to move forward to on ebooks. And what happened was, when they went to this model and Amazon was forced to stop selling books at a loss as ebooks, that the market sort of got more competitive. In 2010, when this was happening, Amazon had 90% of the market. Then the Nook started making strides and the iPad took off. And today, Amazon has 60% of the ebook market. The Nook has 25%, and Apple has 15%. That, by the way, leaves 0% for all the independent bookstores and chains because they're not in the ebook business right now. So it worked as far as creating competition, but if it was done in an illegal manner, the DOJ had to act.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw so many different news shows say this is really difficult to explain. I'm like, no, it's not. Companies can't get into a room together and decide how an industry should go. They do that with oil. That's why oil prices are so screwed up. So, right. You know, that's cartels. That's collusion. You cannot do that. But, you know, somebody said the Columbia Journalism Review was saying, what kind of sense does it make for companies to fix prices to make less money, which is what the publishers were actually doing? They were going to make less money on this agency model. And this is Ryan Chittum over at CJR. He says the publishers were gravely worried, as you say, about the monopoly power of Amazon. But what one of the comments says is that the DOJ's decision to go after publishers to force down the price of ebooks can only lead to a squeeze on publishing companies, both small and large, with a negative ripple effect on what writers, researchers, illustrators, designers, photographers, and marketers are paid. And right away, Amazon said, we're lowering prices.
That's right. The day after, they said, we get to go back to our $10 a book price, which they're going to do, which in some cases, they'll be selling for less than cost.
Right.
Another big ramification was that 16 states sued for the price fixing, and they settled already with Hachette and Harper. And those two companies agreed to put together a total of $51 million to compensate consumers in those states for having, you know, raised prices of books when it wasn't necessary.
Well, you know, as the CJR pointed out, in the short run, this will benefit consumers, but it probably won't in the long run.
Right. And if there is anything, any more, you know, salt in the wound, Amazon announced their new fall list of books that they're publishing. Because not only are they selling books less than cost, not only are they making it easier than ever for authors to self-publish books via, you know, ebooks and Kindle and their program, they're also signing up authors to eliminate the publisher completely, signing up big names like Penny Marshall, the actress and director, her autobiography is coming out in September, and all these other big names that they have 9 books coming out in the fall that they're going to be publishing and putting out into bookstores as well. So a little more salt in the wound. It's like, not only are we encroaching here, there, we're coming everywhere.
Right. And this is at a time when, well, first of all, if I was a publisher, I'd start charging Amazon $50 per book.
But they have 60% of your market.
Yeah, that's the problem. Yeah. And it's growing because digital sales for the first quarter of 2012 at Amazon were up 29%. So
does digital include just books or is that everything?
It's
is that music, books,
it's
digital,
everything,
movies?
Everything. Uh-huh. As a matter of fact, music is estimated to account for 12% of Amazon's total digital sales. The rest are movies and music.
And what about iTunes?
And sorry, movies and books.
Right.
iTunes was flat. I think it increased 2% only.
Yeah, iTunes, they're finding the iPad is not really a world for ebooks. I read ebooks on iPads, but apparently they're just, you know, the Apple Store is just not that strong on ebooks.
Yeah,
so Amazon Way has a huge head start on that.
What do you think of Amazon's plans to dust off your old CD collection? They're willing to buy back your old CDs.
I don't know anything about this. What is it?
So they announced a trade-in program. That's the word I was looking for, trade-in. So users can send in old video games or books or Blu-ray or DVDs or, you know, CDs, and Amazon will give you store credit. And that, you know, if an item meets certain criteria that Amazon has put in place, you know, they get to, and the user prints out a shipping label and slaps it on a package and sends it to Amazon, and they get store credit for it. But just to give you some example, and this is probably the worst example, Adele's 21 can be purchased on Amazon right now in CD form, $9.99. But the maximum trade-in value is $2.30. That's probably because they have too many used copies of it. But
I'm sure you couldn't sell it for $2.30 online. I'm sure they're being sold for a penny with the person making maybe 50 cents or a dollar on shipping and handling.
Right.
Because there's so many copies out there. Not that people are trying to en masse try to sell their Adele CDs. They're perfectly happy with the album. It's just, you know, when you got 8-10 million copies out there, there's going to be a lot available in the used market.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder what's going to happen to places like Amoeba Music here in Los Angeles, and there's one in Berkeley. It was rated, I mean, there was like this NCAA-type ranking of all the things in Southern California. The weather, Disneyland, the Dodgers, the Angels, and Amoeba Records beat everything. It finally came down to the weather versus Amoeba Records, and Amoeba Records won. That should the LA Weekly did this, and they're half new music, new CDs, and half.
But is Amazon planning to sell this stuff?
I have no idea. If they don't sell it, then they're not turning into Amoeba Music. If they do start selling it, then yes, they've turned into Amoeba Music.
Well, but you can already buy everything on Amazon anyway.
Right. I mean,
you can already buy used copies of everything anyway. They just want to get people to get more store credit to buy more stuff.
Right, because, you know, people who have store credit and are shopping on store credit spend about 40% more than the credit they have. So if you have $10, you're actually going to spend, I don't know, $14 or $15.
And so the final indignity, to wind all this up, all this news about publishing, the final indignity was that the Pulitzer Prizes were announced this week, and they didn't even bother to announce a winner for fiction.
Really? 50 Shades of Grey didn't win?
I think that was 2010. But as if, you know, if there wasn't enough bad news piling up, they said no book was worthy of it. There were three finalists. They were Train Dream by Dennis Johnson, which is sort of a novella, David Foster Wallace's unfinished novel, The Pale King, and Karen Russell's Swamplandia. So the panel was only able to consider those three books, whether any one of those three should be a Pulitzer winner. I've only read Train Dream. I would not have named it a Pulitzer Prize winner. Given descriptions of the other two, I can understand why somebody might have chosen the Wallace, but I don't know. And Swamplandia was a well thought of, you know, novel with some mixed reviews. But if you're choosing between those three, I'm not necessarily surprised that they didn't name a winner. But it's the first time since 1977, and that was the year that the people nominated A River Runs Through It, a classic book by Norman MacLean, which they rejected and said, no, we're not going to name it the best book of the year. And so there was no winner that year.
Wow. Well, you're right. I did skip over that. I apologize.
No need to apologize at all. It's just sort of the final. And of course, everybody in the book industry is like, oh, for God's sake, there was no book you could find worthy. Though, frankly, if I was nominating a book, I haven't read enough to know about all the best books of the year, because that's a big, you can do nothing else if you're going to be focused on that. But I would have definitely think The Brothers Sisters by Patrick DeWitt, which is a blackly humorous Western, I would think that was a Pulitzer worthy book. And I would say The Buddha in the Attic by Julie Otsuka, which I've been a big fan of all year long, was also very worthy of being nominated for a Pulitzer. So I'm sorry they weren't on the shortlist.
Well, everybody's a winner here at Showbiz Sandbox, and we thank you for taking the time to listen to us and to download our podcast. In fact, you can subscribe to the podcast in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher Radio. I think that's at stitcher.com, if I'm not mistaken. Please rate and review our show on all of those podcast aggregators. You can also subscribe in an RSS reader or a podcatcher. You can get an email every time we post a new episode. You can follow us on Twitter. Our username is Showbiz Sandbox. You can like us on Facebook. Our username, ironically, Showbiz Sandbox. Links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. And that's also where you'll find all of the ways to subscribe to us or to follow us or to like us or to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or to call us, 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Did I mention that our website was showbizsandbox.com?
Yes, you did.
Okay, just checking. Now, Michael, you have a website.
I think it's called michaelgiltz.com.
And that's where all of your writing can be found. Some of my writing can be found on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week. Actually, not until next week. Programming note, we will be off next week.
Oh, who knew? I didn't know.
We just found out. So
you just told me.
Well, until the week after next, play nice.